Before we jump in, this deep dive is brought to you by Cert Fuel. They've got a full Series 24 course with, adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams that are weighted exactly like the real thing. Check it out at certfuel.com.
Yeah, highly recommend them.
Definitely. Okay, so imagine you are a regulator, right?
Right.
You're looking at Wall Street and you realize you have this massive structural problem.
Oh, a huge problem.
Yeah, you have analysts whose entire job is to give objective advice to the public, but they are sitting in the exact same building as investment bankers. And those bankers, their job is to aggressively sell companies to the public.
Right. So the conflict of interest isn't just a possibility. I mean, it's practically the foundation of the business model.
Exactly. So studying for the Series 24, especially Function 5, is basically studying the rule book designed to keep those two sides from colluding. And I'll be honest, when you read this stuff in a textbook, it feels like, well, like a dictionary written by a lawyer who actively wants you to fail.
It really does. The material is notoriously dry. It's just this endless labyrinth of, compliance walls, safe harbors, disclosure technicalities.
Oh, yeah.
And if you just try to memorize the bullet points, they completely evaporate from your working memory the second you sit down for the exam.
Which is exactly why we are ditching the textbook approach today. Our mission is to break down this regulatory firewall by looking at the actual mechanisms behind the rules. We need to understand why FINRA is so terrified of these conflicts.
Yeah, the motivation behind the rules is key.
Right. So to do that, we're going to use a recurring cast of characters to play out these scenarios. Because, if you can visualize the crime, you can remember the rule.
So, listener, let me introduce you to your new study group. First, we have Analyst Alice. She's a brilliant, chronically stressed equity researcher.
Probably drinks way too much espresso.
Oh, way too much. She builds these massive valuation models, and her entire job is to write objective research reports for her clients.
Okay, and then on the other side of the building, we have Banker Bob. Yes, Bob. Bob is a caricature of a sleazy investment banker. He is entirely bonus-driven. His only goal in life is to convince companies to hire him to take them public or issue new stock.
Right.
He's constantly trying to hype up his deals, and he desperately needs Alice to write nice things about the companies he's wooing.
Naturally. But we also need a subject for them to fight over, right? Like an issuer.
Enter Frank the founder. Frank is the CEO of a highly questionable yet incredibly lucrative startup. Let's say he manufactures glow-in-the-dark mayonnaise.
Glow-in-the-dark mayonnaise. Okay, I love it.
Ticker symbol GLOW. Frank wants to go public and make billions. And finally, operating entirely outside this firm, on the buy side, we have manager Mike. Mike is an institutional money manager. He manages billions in client funds, and he's perpetually looking for creative, borderline illegal ways to expense luxury items and call it investment research.
Right. It's a ridiculous cast, but honestly, they are going to perfectly illustrate the exact mechanics of Function 5.
They really will.
So if we start at the very beginning of the regulatory framework, before we even get to the firewall between Alice and Bob, we have to establish jurisdiction.
Right.
MRA cannot police Alice unless she is actually producing what they legally consider a research report.
I assume that's a heavily guarded definition, right?
Yeah.
Because if I'm a compliance officer, I'd argue that literally nothing we publish is a research report just to escape the regulatory nightmare. What's the actual threshold?
Well, MNRA uses a very strict two-part test. For communication to trigger all the Function 5 compliance rules, both elements have to be present. First, the content must be about an equity security or an issuer of equity security.
Okay, equity security.
And second, it must provide information reasonably sufficient upon which to base an investment decision.
Okay, let me test the boundaries of that.
Okay.
Let's say Alice comes into the office, she's had three espressos, and she fires off a quick morning email blast to 1,000 clients. All it says is, hey everyone, we really like Frank's Glow Mayo stock at $40 a share, buy it. She gives a specific equity, and she gives a recommendation. Does that trigger the research report rules?
Actually, it escapes the definition.
Wait, really? It literally says buy it.
It does, but it fails part two of the test.
Yeah.
While she is talking about an equity security, she hasn't provided information reasonably sufficient to base an investment decision on.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, we like it at 40 is just an opinion. It's not analysis. There's no cash flow model, no discussion of the condiment supply chain, no risk factors.
Right.
So FINRA says an investor couldn't reasonably read that three-word email and make an informed decision. It's a communication, sure, and it's subject to general communication rules, but it is not a research report.
That feels like a massive loophole. But I do see the logic. You can't regulate every casual sentence an analyst utters as if it's a formal thesis. What about the reverse, though? Let's say Alice spends 6 months writing a 60-page, incredibly dense macroeconomic overview of the global condiment industry. She covers supply chain issues for eggs, vinegar tariffs, the impact of climate change on mustard seeds. It's a masterpiece of analysis.
Sounds thrilling.
Truly. But she never once names Frank's company or any other individual stock.
Right. So in that scenario, she fails part one. There's no specific equity, security, or issuer named. It's just macro commentary.
Okay.
The Function 5 rules we're about to discuss, you know, the intense conflict of interest rules, they're designed to prevent analysts from pumping specific stocks to help investment bankers. If there is no specific stock, there's no specific banking deal to protect. So macro research is exempt.
Hold on. Let me pause right here because my exam radar is going off. Exam trap time. I'm taking this test, and I feel like the question writers are going to lay a trap based on the format of the report, not just the content.
Oh, you are anticipating the exact trick they use. The exam will give you a scenario focused heavily on the medium. They'll ask, you know, is a PDF a research report? Is an email blast a research report? What if it's a transcript of a podcast? Or a tweet?
And the answer is that the regulatory framework is completely medium agnostic, right? The format literally does not matter.
Doesn't matter at all.
If Alice posts a tweet that somehow manages to name an equity security and provides a link to a chart that is reasonably sufficient to make an investment decision, boom, that tweet is a research report.
Exactly.
Conversely, if she prints her We Like It opinion on gold leaf paper and binds it in leather, it's still not a research report. Content dictates the rule, not the medium.
Precisely. And that concept, you know, prioritizing substance over form, brings us to a parallel trap, which is identifying who is actually a research analyst.
Right. Because if you are designated as a research analyst, you have to pass the Series 86 and 87 exams. 86 covers the brutal financial modeling and analysis, and 87 covers the regulatory side. But who was actually forced to take those?
Well, the requirement is based entirely on your primary job function or having your name printed on the report. It has absolutely nothing to do with your corporate job title.
Okay, let me ask the listener a direct question to lock this in. I want you to stop and think about this for a beat. Imagine a guy whose official HR title is Strategy Associate. He sits at his desk, and his primary daily function is writing equity recommendations that get sent out to clients. Does he need to pass the Series 86 and 87?
Give them a second.
Okay, time's up. Yes. Function over org chart.
Yep.
Fine Rod does not care about made-up corporate titles. He is producing the substantive views of a research report, so he is an analyst.
And let's look at the inverse, too. You could have an executive whose official title is Global Head of Research. But if her job is strictly managing the department budget, handling HR disputes, and she never actually writes, reviews, or influences the content of the equity reports, she's not required to hold the 86 or 87. She's managing people, not producing research.
I love that. Function over title, content over medium. So we've established our gateway. Alice is officially functioning as an analyst, and she's writing a full 20-page analytical report on Frank's Glomeo. She crosses the threshold. Now we have to build the firewall between her and banker Bob.
This is the absolute core of Function 5, the information barrier. Structurally, research and investment banking must operate as if they are in two separate universes.
Let's look at the motives here, because Bob makes his massive multi-million-dollar bonus when Frank, the founder, hires the firm to underwrite a secondary offering.
Right.
Bob is desperate for Frank's business. But Frank, being a greedy founder, says, Bob, I'll hire your firm, but only if your analyst Alice writes a strong buy rating on my stock to drive the price up before we sell. Bob's incentive to pressure Alice is astronomically high. How does the rulebook surgically remove Bob from the equation?
It starts with an absolute prohibition on pre-publication review. Bob cannot, under any circumstances, review a draft of Alice's research report before it is published to the public.
Okay, I'm going to play devil's advocate here. What if Bob just wants to fact check it? Let's say Bob is intimately familiar with Frank's business model. Bob just wants to read the draft to ensure Alice spelled Frank's name right and that the historical revenue numbers for Q3 are accurate. He's not touching the rating. Surely, for the sake of accuracy, Fine Anne allows a factual review by the banker.
No, Fine Anara explicitly bans that. If Alice needs to verify facts, that review process must go to non-investment banking personnel.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, she can send it to legal, she can send it to compliance, or she can even send the draft with the rating, price target, and summary removed directly to the subject company. Frank can check his own revenue numbers, but it never goes through Banker Bob.
Why, though? If Bob is just checking facts, what's the harm?
Because access is leverage. If Bob is allowed to read the draft, even under the guise of fact-checking, he sees Alice's evaluation model. He can walk over to her desk and say, "Hey, Alice, revenue looks good, but your growth assumptions for year three look a little pessimistic, don't you think? Frank's not going to like that."
I see.
Yeah, Bob uses the factual review as a Trojan horse to manipulate the tone of the report. By completely locking him out of the draft, Fionnuala severs his ability to apply that subtle pressure.
That makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
You can't let the fox audit the hen house, so Bob can't read the draft. What about assigning the work? Can Bob walk into research and say, "Hey, we are trying to win Frank's business. I need someone to initiate coverage on Glomeo this week"?
No. Coverage decisions are the exclusive domain of research management. Investment banking cannot demand that a company be covered. And equally important, they cannot demand that coverage be dropped.
Okay.
If Alice puts a sell rating on Glomeo and Frank calls Bob screaming, threatening to pull his banking business, Bob cannot go to research and force them to drop coverage just to appease Frank.
So operationally, they're on separate islands. But investment banking is a sales business. When Bob goes to actually pitch Frank on hiring the firm, he's taking a whole team with him in a conference room. Can Alice come along to that pitch meeting? I mean, she's the expert on the condiment sector. She can explain the market dynamics to Frank.
The default rule is a hard no. Alice cannot attend roadshows, and she cannot participate in investment banking pitch meetings. Research cannot be weaponized as a marketing tool to win deals.
Right.
If she is in the room, her mere presence implies to Frank, "Hey, if you hire us, this analyst will take care of your stock."
I feel a but coming. The default rule is no, but.
But there is one major exception carved out by the JOBS Act, and it revolves around EGCs, which are emerging growth companies.
Okay, let's unpack this. What makes a company an EGC, and why do they get a special loophole?
Well, an EGC is generally a company with under roughly $1 billion in gross revenue. The JOBS Act was passed to make it easier for these smaller companies to raise capital and go public.
Okay.
So Congress decided that for these smaller emerging companies, the flow of information is so critical that they were willing to relax the firewall just a bit. So if Bob is pitching Frank for an EGC initial public offering and IPO, Alice is permitted to attend the pitch meeting.
Wait, really? So she goes to the pitch for Glomeo's IPO. Can she stand up at the whiteboard and say, "Frank, if you give Bob the underwriting mandate, I will personally guarantee a buy rating and a $50 price target"?
Oh, absolutely not. No, she can attend the pitch, but her role is strictly limited to diligence and sector expertise. She still cannot actively market the investment banking services, and she certainly cannot promise favorable research.
Got it.
She is there to ask Frank questions and understand the business model, not to sell the deal. And keep in mind, this exception is incredibly narrow. It is only for EGC IPO pitches. If it's a pitch for a secondary offering or if Frank's company is too big to be an EGC, Alice is banned from the room again.
This feels like walking a tightrope over a volcano.
Yeah.
But let's look at the ultimate incentive here, which is the money. Because if Alice's paycheck is tied to Bob's success, no amount of structural firewalls will stop the corruption. She will find a way to write what Bob wants if Bob is funding her mortgage.
Exactly, which is why the compensation rules are the most scrutinized part of Function 5. The fundamental rule is that analyst compensation cannot be tied directly or indirectly to specific investment banking transactions.
Right. I think of it like a sports referee. Imagine an NFL referee getting a cash bonus from the home team every time they score a touchdown. The integrity of the game is instantly destroyed. Alice is the referee. She cannot get paid based on the outcome of Bob's deal.
Direct ties are obvious violations. If Bob hands Alice a check for 10 grand after the Glomeo deal closes, they are both getting barred from the industry. But the exam is going to test the indirect ties.
Okay, give me an example of an indirect tie that sounds innocent but is actually illegal.
Let's look at the annual bonus pool. It's December. The firm is calculating bonuses. Alice had a great year. You know, her stock picks were incredibly accurate. But she finds out her bonus pool is sized based on the firm's overall investment banking revenue for the year. The more deals Bob closed, the bigger the pie Alice gets a slice of.
So she's not getting paid for the Glomeo deal specifically, but she is financially invested in Bob having a blockbuster year overall.
Exactly. And that is a severe violation. It aligns her baseline financial incentives with the investment banking division's success. To prevent this, Fionnuala dictates exactly how Alice must be paid.
Right.
The committee that determines her compensation must have zero investment banking representatives on it. None. Bob cannot have a seat at that table.
So who decides her pay, and what metrics are they legally allowed to use?
Research management and executive management decide, and they have to thoroughly document the basis for her pay. They use metrics like the historical accuracy of her recommendations, her productivity, client feedback, and the overall quality of her analysis. They can look at the general financial health of the overall firm, but they cannot link her pay to IB revenue pools.
Okay, let's play out a darker scenario. Alice is a good analyst. She tastes the glow-in-the-dark mayo, she runs the chemical analysis, and she realizes it's functionally toxic. She downgrades Frank's stock to a strong sell. Frank is furious. He calls Bob and says, I am pulling all my banking business from your firm because of Alice. Bob is watching millions of dollars evaporate. He storms over to the research department, corners Alice by the espresso machine, and says, if you don't upgrade that stock to a bye-bye tomorrow morning, I am going to make your life a living hell and have you fired.
Wow.
But he doesn't actually follow through. He just yells at her.
Yeah.
Is that a Funeraria violation?
Yes, absolutely. That is a direct violation of the anti-retaliation rule. The rule explicitly states that threatened retaliation is sufficient to trigger a violation.
Okay.
Bob doesn't actually have to fire her. If he threatens to cut her bonus or move her desk to the basement or freeze her out of management meetings, the violation has occurred. The firm cannot retaliate or threaten to retaliate against an analyst for publishing adverse negative research.
Good. The rule book gives Alice a shield. But Alice isn't a saint by default, right?
Yeah.
She has her own personal greed to manage. What are the rules on Alice's personal trading account?
Well, the rules are designed to prevent her from exploiting her own market influence. The first major restriction is that Alice cannot front-run her own reports.
Which means if she is writing a massive market-moving upgrade on Glomeo that she plans to publish on Friday, she can't log into her personal E-Trade account on Thursday and load up on shares before the public reads her report.
Correct. That is a form of insider trading utilizing material non-public information, you know, her own impending report. Secondly, she cannot trade against her most recent recommendation.
So if she has a buy rating on Glomeo, she cannot hold a short position in her personal account. That makes sense. It would be incredibly hypocritical. But what if she thinks the whole condiment sector is going to crash? She leaves her Glomeo rating as a buy, but she buys a massive short position in a condiment sector ETF. The ETF happens to be heavily weighted with Glomeo. Has she found a loophole?
She has not. Finera anticipated that. The restriction on trading against your recommendation extends to derivatives, options, and funds that are materially dependent on the subject's security. You cannot do an end run around the rule using an ETF. Furthermore, analysts are prohibited from purchasing pre-IPO shares in the same industry they cover.
Wait, why that specific rule?
Think about the incentive. If Alice covers the condiment sector and a private ketchup company offers her cheap pre-IPO shares, they're essentially buying her future goodwill. When that company eventually goes public, Alice is heavily incentivized to initiate coverage with a glowing buy rating to pump the value of her own pre-IPO shares.
Ah, it's a preemptive bribe. Okay, so we've built the Great Wall. We've kept Bob out of Alice's drafts. We've protected her paycheck. We've stopped Bob from threatening her, and we've locked down her personal trading. Alice finishes her completely unbiased report on Glomeo.
Right.
But before it gets emailed to 1,000 institutional clients, someone has to stamp it with approval, right? And the front page needs to look like the warning label on experimental heart medication.
That is exactly what it looks like. Let's talk about the gatekeepers. Before publication, the report must be approved by a specifically qualified principal. This must be a supervisory analyst holding a Series 16 license, or a research principal, holding a Series 24 combined with a 16 or 87.
Hold on, let me interrupt, because if I'm studying for the Series 24, this feels incredibly confusing. I am taking the Series 24 to be a principal. Why isn't my license alone enough to approve a research report?
This is a classic exam trap. The Series 24 is a framework qualification. It means you are qualified to design and oversee the general compliance system of the firm, but it does not test the highly specific, nuanced skills required to evaluate the factual basis of a complex financial model.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, that is what the Series 16, the supervisory analyst, and the Series 87, the research analyst exams are for. So a Series 24 can approve the report, but only if they also hold the 16 or 87. You cannot just slap a 24 signature on a research report and call it a day.
Got it. So the Series 16 supervisor analyst gets the draft. What exactly are they looking for? If Alice writes a report saying Glomeo is going to zero, and the supervisory analyst personally believes Glomeo is a great company, can the SA block the report just because they disagree with the conclusion?
No. The supervisor analyst is not there to act as an investment committee. Disagreement with the analyst's conclusion is not grounds for refusing approval.
Okay.
The SA is reviewing for factual basis, meaning do the numbers actually add up? They are checking to ensure the conclusions are reasonable based on the presented facts, even if they disagree with them. And most importantly, they are verifying that every single required disclosure is plastered on the report.
Let's talk about those disclosures. What actually goes on that front page warning label?
They are heavily focused on transparency regarding potential conflicts. You must disclose if the analyst has any financial interest in the company. You must disclose if there are any material conflicts of interest. But the most heavily tested disclosures revolve around investment banking compensation.
The money trail. What's the specific time frame we have to disclose?
You must disclose if the firm received investment banking compensation from the subject company in the past 12 months. And you must look forward. You must disclose if the firm expects to receive or intends to seek investment banking compensation in the next 3 months.
12 months looking backward, 3 months looking forward. Okay, listener, I have another direct question for you. Stop what you are doing. Listen to this scenario. Alice is completely clean. She owns 0% of Frank's Glomeo stock. She has no financial interest. But T, the firm's proprietary trading desk, the internal traders who trade with the firm's own money, owns 1.5% of Frank's outstanding stock. Does Alice's report need to disclose this ownership?
Give him a beat.
Time's up. Yes. The 1% ownership disclosure is a firm-wide threshold.
I cannot emphasize this enough. This is one of the most heavily tested disclosure items on the Series 24. The 1% threshold aggregates the entire firm's beneficial ownership. It includes the prop desk, affiliates, and error accounts. If the firm, in total, is at or above 1% ownership of the subject company, it must be prominently disclosed on the research report, regardless of whether the analyst owns a single share. Finera's logic is that if the firm owns that much stock, the firm has a vested interest in the stock price going up, which compromises the objectivity of the firm's research.
Okay, so the report is approved. The 1% ownership is disclosed. The 12-month backward IB comp is disclosed. The report is ready to go. Can I, as the broker-dealer, send this report to my biggest, highest-paying clients an hour before I send it to the retail clients? A little VIP treatment.
Absolutely not. Finera requires fair and equitable distribution. You cannot selectively distribute research to favored clients before broader dissemination. That is a massive violation.
What about internally? Can I send the approved report to my firm's own trading desk an hour before the clients get it so our traders can position themselves ahead of the market reaction?
That is textbook front running. Pre-publication disclosure of research report to internal trading desks or the internal sales force is a severe violation of the information barrier. Everyone entitled to the research gets it simultaneously.
Okay, so the written reports are locked down tighter than Fort Knox. But here is the reality of the modern financial media landscape. Alice isn't just sitting at a desk typing PDFs. She is a personality. She gets invited on CNBC. She goes on popular investing podcasts to talk about the condiment sector. How do these rigid written rules translate to a live, spoken environment where there's no page one to print a warning label on?
This introduces the regulatory concept of a public appearance. When Alice leaves the controlled environment of a written report, she enters a whole new minefield of compliance.
What exactly counts as a public appearance?
The definition is intentionally broad. Seminars, industry conferences, live radio, television interviews, podcasts, call-in shows, even a post on a social media platform like Twitter or X, if it makes a recommendation, can be considered a public appearance. Essentially, if you are delivering a substantive view to an undefined public audience, you are making a public appearance.
But there has to be a threshold, right? If Alice is at a dinner party and tells three people she likes Glomeo, is that a public appearance?
No. There is a specific small audience carve-out. If the presentation or recommendation reaches fewer than 15 people and there are no media representatives present, it is not a public appearance. So if Alice goes into a closed-door boardroom and pitches her research to four institutional portfolio managers, that does not trigger the public appearance disclosures.
Okay, but if she's on a live podcast with 10,000 listeners, she definitely crosses the threshold. How does she handle the disclosures? Does she have to read the warning label out loud? Like, she's having a normal, fluid conversation about mayonnaise. Does she have to physically interrupt herself to say, by the way, my firm expects IB compensation from Frank in the next 3 months?
Yes. She must make the required disclosures during the appearance itself. She has to verbally state if she has a financial interest, any material conflicts, the backward 12-month IB comp, and the forward 3-month expected IV comp.
That sounds incredibly awkward for the analyst. Can't you just go on the podcast, give a brilliant analysis, and then an hour later post a tweet that says, "Hey everyone, regarding my podcast interview, click this link for my regulatory disclosures." Or if she's on CNBC, can't the TV producer just put the disclosures in that tiny scrolling Chyron text at the bottom of the screen while she talks?
Neither of those work. A follow-up tweet is non-compliant because the audience might not see it. A Chyron on a television screen does not count because FINRA doesn't trust viewers to read the fine print while listening to the analyst. The analyst is expected to actually vocalize the conflicts of interest while making the recommendation. The friction is completely intentional.
It forces transparency in real time. I love that. Now, alongside FINRA's rules, we have the SEC weighing in with Regulation AC. Reg AC stands for Analyst Certification. What is the mechanism here?
Reg AC is entirely about calendar discipline and legal accountability. It requires two distinct signed certifications from the analyst. The first is a per-report certification. Printed on every single research report, Alice has to sign a statement swearing that the views expressed accurately reflect her personal views and that no part of her compensation was tied to the specific recommendation.
Basically, a legal affidavit saying, "I actually believe this analysis, and Banker Bob didn't bribe me to write it."
Exactly. The per-report certification is straightforward, but the second requirement, the quarterly certification, is where firms get into massive trouble.
Walk me through it.
Within 30 days after the end of each calendar quarter, the firm's compliance department must obtain a record from Alice swearing that every single public appearance she made during that entire quarter accurately reflected her honest personal views and that her compensation was not tied to what she said on air.
Okay, but let's be real. It's an administrative signature. What happens if the compliance officer goes on vacation, Alice is traveling, and they just forget? They miss the 30-day window by a week. Mm. They eventually get the signature, but it's late. What's the penalty? A small fine.
It is a catastrophe for the firm and the analyst. If the firm fails to obtain that quarterly certification within the 30-day window, they must promptly notify FINR. And the penalty is draconian. For the next 120 days, every single research report, Alice writes, must include a prominent disclosure stating that she failed to certify her public appearances.
Oh my God, the 120-day public shaming. That is brutal. Every time she publishes a brilliant model, the front page basically screams to her clients, "Hi, I'm Alice, and I couldn't be bothered to legally swear I wasn't corrupt last quarter." Her credibility would be decimated for a third of a year.
Which is exactly why it is penalized so harshly. FINRA uses public humiliation as a compliance enforcement tool. The Series 24 principal's job is to build an ironclad compliance calendar. Missing that 30-day window is not an option because there is no grace period and no way to quietly fix it.
Note to self, if I am a principal, I am handcuffing Alice to her desk on day 29 until she signs that form. Okay, so we've covered the reports, the disclosures, the podcast. Let's shift to a massive structural market event. So Banker Bob finally achieves his dream. He successfully takes Frank's Glow Mayo company public. The IPO prices on a Thursday night. The stock starts trading on Friday morning. The champagne is popped. I assume Alice is immediately rushing back to her desk to fire off a strong buy rating on Monday morning to keep the stock price rocketing. That's what Frank expects, right?
If she does that, both she and the firm are looking at massive violations because of a concept called the quiet period. The rules strictly prohibit a participating firm from publishing research or making public appearances regarding an issuer for a defined window of time after an offering.
I understand the rule, but why does it exist? Why does FINRA shut down research right when investors probably want it the most?
Because a buy report published by the lead manager the day after an IPO is structurally indistinguishable from deal promotion. If Bob's team just sold millions of shares to the public and Alice immediately publishes a glowing report, it's just a marketing brochure disguised as independent research. FINRA shuts research down to allow the market to digest the official SEC prospectus without the underwriter artificially pumping the stock with hype. It's a cooling off period.
Okay, that makes sense. We need a cooling off period. What are the specific time frames? Because I know the exam's going to test the exact days.
It depends entirely on the type of offering. For an initial public offering, an IPO, where the company is hitting the public market for the first time, the quiet period is 10 calendar days after the offering date. And this applies broadly. It applies to any firm that acted as a manager, co-manager, underwriter, or even just a dealer in the syndicate.
10 days for an IPO. But what if it's a secondary offering? Frank's company is already public. It's been trading for a year, but he wants to sell a new block of shares to raise more capital.
For a secondary or follow-on offering, the market already has a track record of the stock. So the quiet period is shorter, it's just 3 calendar days, and critically, it only applies to the managers or co-managers of the offering. The lower-level syndicate members are not subject to the 3-day quiet period for a secondary offering.
Okay, listener, direct question time again. I want you to calculate this in your head. An IPO price is on a Friday. The quiet period is 10 days. When does the quiet period end, and when can Alice publish her research? Is it 2 Fridays from now?
Think about the days carefully.
No. It is 10 calendar days. The quiet period ends on the second Sunday, meaning she can publish on the second Monday. Do not count business days on this exam. Weekends count. Holidays count. There are calendar days.
The exam writers know that candidates confuse business days with calendar days across different FINRA rules. For Function 5 quiet periods, lock in the word calendar.
Hold on. Tone shift, because this feels like the biggest exam trap of the entire section. I was looking at an older study guide the other day, and I saw a rule about a 15-day quiet period tied to a lockup agreement expiration. Like when the insiders are finally allowed to sell their stock, there's a 15-day quiet period around that date. If I see a question about a 15-day lockup quiet period on the Series 24, how should I handle it?
You cross it out immediately. It is a dead rule.
Why did FINRA kill it? What's the history there?
Well, historically, companies would intentionally align their lockup expirations with major positive news, like an earnings release. And analysts would publish booster shot reports right around that time to pump the stock price up so the insiders could sell at a premium.
Clever.
Yeah, so FINRA originally implemented a 15-day quiet period around the expiration to stop this. But eventually, they realized that other rules, like the general prohibition on trading against recommendations and tighter disclosure rules, already prevented the most egregious manipulation.
Right.
The 15-day rule was just unnecessarily restricting the flow of information. So they abolished it. It only exists on the exam as a wrong answer trap for people who studied outdated materials.
Good riddance. So we only care about the 10-day IPO and 3-day secondary quiet periods. Are there any exceptions to those? What if Glomeo's main factory explodes on day 4 of the IPO quiet period? Alice has to be able to tell her clients what that means, right?
Yes. There is an exception for significant news or events. If there's a major development, an unexpected M&A announcement, a massive regulatory fine, or a factory exploding research can be published. But Alice cannot self-authorize this. She can't just decide the news is significant enough. Legal and compliance personnel must authorize the publication, and they must document their reasoning in the supervisory file. What about our EGC exception? Does the JOBS Act poke a hole in the quiet period too?
A massive hole. Under the JOBS Act, emerging growth companies have no quiet periods. None. The day after an EGC IPO, the underwriter's analyst can legally publish a research report. The legislature decided that for small companies, the need for market visibility outweighs the risk of underwriter hype.
Okay, so FINRA is satisfied. But FINRA isn't the only regulator in town. We have the SEC, and we have the Securities Act of 1933. You mentioned earlier that publishing a research report during an offering can accidentally trigger a Securities Act violation. How does a research report become an illegal prospectus?
This is where firms face massive federal liability. Under the Securities Act, a prospectus is defined incredibly broadly. It is essentially any written communication that offers to sell a security.
I see where this is going.
Right. If your firm is in the middle of distributing a registered offering for Glomeo, and Alice publishes a glowing research report, the SEC might view that report as a written offer to sell the security. But because it doesn't contain all the massive legal disclosures of the official SEC-filed prospectus, it is deemed an illegal prospectus. This is known as gun jumping.
So even if FINRA says the quiet period is over, the SEC might sue you for gun jumping because the distribution is still ongoing. That sounds like a nightmare. How do firms ever publish research?
The SEC recognized the chilling effect this would have on market research, so they created safe harbors. If your research report meets the strict conditions of a safe harbor, the SEC legally guarantees they will not classify it as an illegal prospectus. There are 2 primary safe harbors for participating broker-dealers that you need to know for the exam.
Let's break them down. Safe Harbor 1.
Safe Harbor 1 is the different class safe harbor. This allows you to publish research on a class of the issuer's securities that is not currently being distributed. For example, if your firm is currently underwriting a new offering of Frank's non-convertible debt, his bonds, Alice is perfectly safe to publish a research report on Frank's common stock.
Because they are fundamentally different securities, Hyping the stock doesn't legally constitute an offer to sell the bonds.
Correct. But here is the massive trap the SEC laid, and the exam will definitely test it. Convertible debt is legally treated as common stock.
Consider my mind blown. Walk me through the mechanics of why.
Well, convertible debt gives the bondholder the right to convert that bond into shares of common stock. Their value is intrinsically linked. If you publish a research report hyping the common stock, you are mathematically increasing the value of the convertible debt.
Oh, wow.
Therefore, the SEC says, if your firm is distributing convertible debt, Alice cannot use the safe harbor to write about the common stock. They are treated as the same class.
I guarantee that is an exam question. Firm is underwriting convertible preferred. Can the analyst write a report on common? The answer is no. Okay, what is Safe Harbor 2?
Safe Harbor 2 is the regular coverage safe harbor. This applies when you want to write about the exact same security that is currently being distributed. You are allowed to do this under two conditions. First, the issuer must be a large, seasoned company specifically, eligible to use Form S3 or F3 for streamlined SEC registration. Or, if they aren't that big, you can publish a broad industry report, provided you don't give the subject issuer disproportionate space or prominence.
So Alice can't write a 20-page Conman industry review where 19 pages are exclusively praising Glow Mayo and one page is a brief mention of ketchup. That violates the disproportionate prominence rule.
Exactly. But here is the absolute most important requirement that applies to both safe harbors. It is the regular course requirement.
Let me guess. You can't suddenly start caring about the company just because your investment banker has just landed them as a client.
Precisely. The safe harbors only protect research that is published in the regular course of business. You cannot initiate brand new coverage of a company during an offering. You cannot suddenly upgrade your rating methodology just for this one report. The SEC is looking for consistency. They want to ensure the research report isn't a strategically timed booster shot designed to inject hype into the deal.
I love that phrase, booster shot. So if Alice has never written a single word about Glow Mayo in her entire career, and the day Bob prices the secondary offering, she suddenly drops a 50-page strong buy initiation report.
She loses the safe harbor completely. The report is reclassified as an illegal prospectus under the Securities Act, the firm faces massive SEC fines, and she likely violated the FINRA quiet periods as well. It's a multi-agency disaster.
The moral of the story, stick to your regular publishing schedule. Consistency is your legal shield. Okay, we've spent the vast majority of this deep dive on the broker-dealer side of the equation. We've managed Alice's conflicts and Bob's greed. Let's pivot entirely. Let's leave the sell side and move to the buy side. I want to talk about Manager Mike.
Manager Mike operates in a completely different reality. He is an institutional money manager. He works for an investment advisor, managing a massive portfolio of client funds, you know, pension money, mutual funds, high net worth individuals.
And because Mike is managing other people's money, he operates under a strict fiduciary duty, meaning every decision he makes has to be in the absolute best interest of his clients. When it comes to trading stock, I assume that means he is legally obligated to get the lowest possible commission rate from whatever broker executes his trades. Best execution.
As a general rule, yes. Fiduciary duty requires seeking best execution, which often means minimizing commission costs. But here is the conflict. Mike wants access to Alice's research. Her valuation models are brilliant. But Alice's broker-dealer doesn't just give that research away for free. They charge higher trade commissions than a bare-bones discount broker.
So Mike is looking at two options. He can trade with a discount broker for 1 cent a share and get no research. Or he can trade with Alice's firm for 3 cents a share and get access to all her brilliant condiment sector analysis. If Mike chooses Alice, isn't he technically violating his fiduciary duty? He is using his client's money through higher commissions to buy research for himself. If a client finds out, they're going to sue him for misusing their assets.
This was a massive problem in the industry, which is why Congress created the soft dollar safe harbor under Section 28E of the Securities Exchange Act.
What does Section 28E actually do?
It provides a legal shield. It explicitly states that a money manager like Mike will not be deemed to have breached his fiduciary duty solely because he pays a higher commission to a broker-dealer who provides research and brokerage services. He is allowed to use soft dollars, client commission dollars to pay for research, as long as he meets three strict conditions.
Okay, Mike loves loopholes. Let's make sure we lock down these conditions. What is condition one?
Condition one, Mike must have investment discretion over the account.
Okay, let me reason through that. If Mike is just a passive executor, like if a client calls and says, buy 100 shares of Apple, and Mike just presses the button, he didn't do any research. So he can't use that client's commission to buy research. He has to actually be the one making the active investment decisions for the portfolio.
Spot on. Condition 2. The service or product he receives must be eligible research or brokerage services. The SEC defines this by asking, does the product provide lawful and appropriate assistance to the money manager in carrying out his investment decision-making responsibilities? Essentially, does it have substantive analytical value?
And condition 3.
Mike must make a good faith determination that the higher commission cost is reasonable in relation to the value of the research provided. He has to actually document that the research is worth the premium he is charging his clients.
Let's focus deeply on condition 2, because this is where Mike is going to try to cheat the system. Eligible versus ineligible. Hard dollars versus soft dollars. If it's eligible, he uses client commissions, so soft dollars. If it's ineligible overhead, he has to pay out of his own pocket, hard dollars.
I'm going to throw some scenarios at you. Mike wants to buy a Bloomberg terminal for his desk. It costs 20 grand a year. It provides real-time charting, financial news, and stock valuation tools.
Eligible. Soft dollars. The terminal directly provides analytical research that assists him in making investment decisions.
Okay, Mike wants to stay sharp on general economic trends, so he wants to buy a premium subscription to the Wall Street Journal and The Economist.
Ineligible. Hard dollars.
Really? Reading the news isn't research.
The SEC draws a line at mass market publications. General circulation newspapers and magazines do not qualify as specialized analytical research. They are considered general overhead. Mike has to pay for his own newspaper subscriptions out of his own pocket. Okay, Mike finds a specialized condiment industry conference happening in Las Vegas. The conference features deep dive presentations on the global mayonnaise supply chain. It's highly analytical. Mike wants to use soft dollars to pay the conference registration fee, his first class flight to Vegas, and his suite at the Bellagio.
This is a classic exam question because it's a split answer. The conference registration fee itself might be eligible for soft dollars because the presentations provide substantive research value. But travel and entertainment are strictly ineligible. Flights, hotels, meals, those are hard dollar expenses. He cannot use client commissions to fund a Vegas vacation under the guise of research.
Classic, Mike. Always trying to expense the hotel. What about the physical infrastructure of his office? The computer monitors, the server racks, the telephone lines.
All ineligible. Physical hardware and telecommunications lines are considered operational overhead. Hard dollars only.
Okay, here's the trickiest scenario. This is where the real compliance headache begins. Let's say Mike buys a massive $100,000 software suite for his firm. It's a bundle. Half of the software features incredibly advanced AI-driven analytical tools for evaluating equity risk. That's clearly eligible. But the other half of the software suite is just basic accounting, compliance, and bookkeeping tools to manage his firm's payroll. That's clearly ineligible. How does he pay for a bundled product?
He must perform a mixed-use allocation.
How did that work in practice? Walk me through the math.
Well, Mike cannot just shrug and say, well, it has some research, I'll put the whole $100,000 on soft dollars. He must make a reasonable good faith allocation between the eligible research component and the ineligible administrative component. Let's say he analyzes the usage and determines it's a 60-40 split. 60% of the software's value is analytical, 40% is accounting.
So he uses soft dollars for $60,000, and he has to write a check from his own firm's bank account for the remaining $40,000 in hard dollars.
Exactly. And the most critical part of this process is documentation. He must document the exact methodology he used to arrive at that 60-40 split. When the SEC audits him, they will demand to see how he justified using client funds for that 60%.
That makes sense. But let me ask you a question from the perspective of our Series 24 candidate. The candidate works for the broker-dealer. They work for Alice and Bob's firm. If Mike messes up his mixed-use allocation, or if Mike tries to use soft dollars to buy a flight to Vegas, is the broker-dealer on the hook for Mike's fiduciary breach?
This is perhaps the most brilliant distinction in the rulebook, and you absolutely must remember it for the exam. The Section 28E, Soft Dollar Safe Harbor, protects the money manager. It is Mike's shield. It does not protect the broker-dealer.
Wait, so Alice's firm gets zero protection from 28D?
Correct. The broker-dealer is not a fiduciary to Mike's clients. The BD's responsibility is entirely administrative and supervisory. The broker-dealer must accurately maintain the books and records of these soft dollar arrangements. If Mike directs the BD to pay an invoice for a Bloomberg terminal using his accrued soft dollars, the BD must keep that invoice and the payment ledger for 3 years, with the first 2 years in an easily accessible location.
Right.
The BD also has a duty to supervise for red flags. If Mike blatantly tries to expense a yacht through the BD, they should flag it. but the actual legal safe harbor against a breach of fiduciary duty belongs exclusively to Mike.
That is a fascinating dynamic. The safe harbor belongs to the buy side, but the sell side has to manage the ledger. Okay, we have covered a monumental amount of ground. We have built the structural firewall. We have locked Bob out of the drafts. We've analyzed the compensation committee. We've navigated the treacherous waters of public appearances and Reg AC. We've calculated calendar days for quiet periods. We've avoided gun jumping with SEC safe harbors. And we've audited Mike's mixed use expenses. It is time for the rapid fire recap.
Let's hammer the most highly testable, easily confused concepts into working memory.
I'll start. Ready?
Yep.
Function over title. HR titles do not matter. If you are writing substantive equity recommendations, you are a research analyst and must hold the Series 86 and 87.
The Series 24 alone cannot approve a research report. You must have the Series 16 supervisory analyst qualification to approve the factual basis and disclosures.
The 1% ownership disclosure is a firm-wide threshold. If the proprietary trading desk owns 1.5%, it goes on the front page of the report, even if the analyst owns nothing.
Disclosures made during public appearances, like a live podcast or a TV interview, must be spoken out loud during the show. You cannot use a follow-up tweet, and you cannot rely on a television chyron.
Missing the 30-day window for a quarterly Reg AC certification results in a draconian penalty, a 120-day public shaming where every subsequent report must state the analyst failed to certify.
Quiet periods use calendar days, not business days. An IPO requires a 10-day quiet period. A secondary offering requires a 3-day quiet period, but only for managers and co-managers.
The 15-day lockup expiration rule is dead. If you see it as an answer choice, cross it out immediately. Emerging growth companies, EGCs, under the JOBS Act have zero quiet period restrictions.
Under the Securities Act safe harbors, convertible debt is legally treated as the exact same class as common stock. You cannot use the different class safe harbor to write about common stock if you are underwriting the convertible debt.
The sock dollar safe harbor protects the money manager's fiduciary duty, not the broker dealer. Mass market newspapers and travel expenses are always hard dollars. Incredible. We've completely decoded function 5.
I want to leave the listener with one final, broader concept to mull over before they take the exam. Think about how fragile objectivity really is in the financial markets. We just spent this entire deep dive navigating a dizzying, complex array of rules, barriers, disclosures, and safe harbors.
So many rules.
Right. And the entire Function 5 rulebook exists because without it, Wall Street's absolute default state is gravity pulling toward corruption. The natural state of a broker-dealer is to use research as nothing more than a thinly veiled marketing brochure for investment banking. Every single rule we discussed today, every disclosure threshold, every quiet period, every restriction on Bob talking to Alice is a monument to a past scandal. It's a reaction to a moment in history where an investor got hurt because they trusted a biased report that was secretly funded by an investment banker. The rules seem annoying and tedious, but they are the only structural scaffolding keeping the analysis honest.
Wow. Every rule is a monument to a past scandal. That is an incredibly powerful way to frame it. Visualizing the inherent corruption makes remembering the compliance so much easier. So you sit down for the Series 24 and you see a massive paragraph-long Function 5 question. Do not panic. Do not get lost in the legal jargon. Just close your eyes and visualize the characters. Visualize analyst Alice trying to do her analytical job. Visualize banker Bob trying to aggressively ruin her objectivity. Visualize Frank the founder demanding a strong buy reading. And visualize manager Mike trying to expense a trip to Vegas under the guise of research. Apply the rules to their motives, and the answers will jump right off the screen. Good luck on the exam, everyone. Keep studying, trust your preparation, and we'll see you on the next deep dive.